First of all, I also want to thank you that you gave me this wonderful opportunity to come here and get to know so many of your colleagues and friends and students. And so about my position in ISKCON, see, ISKCON Society was established by our spiritual master, His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. He went to America in 65 at the age of 70, and single-handedly he started this movement in a very, very humble way. But in 10 years' time, it spread all over the world, and he established 108 temples in all the big cities of the world. And he left this planet in 1977. And when he left, before he left, he designed the structure of our society. The spiritual structure was already there, but the managerial structure was given as a governing body commission. A group of devotees were supposed to manage the international affairs of a society, and that's called the GBC, or Governing Body Commission. And now there are 31 members in the governing body, and I also am one of them. And my involvement in Europe is, I am the governing body commissioner for France, Belgium and Ireland. And also in India I have some involvement too, in Calcutta. And besides that, I preach all over the world practically. Of course, now that I got involved in the management, I cannot give so much time traveling around and preaching, because I already have some specific assignments. There is a lot of, appeal from different parts of the world asking me to go and preach to them.
Thank you.
Welcome.
So we are anxious to hear something about one of the main texts very popular for you, is the
tradition. Yeah, to talk about the history of Srimad Bhagavatam, you see, the Vedas were not written. In the beginning, the Vedas were spoken. And the memory of people were so sharp those days that they could remember just by hearing. Now, writing actually started 5,000 years ago. Actually, this new era called Kali Yuga started 5,000 years ago. Like the way the time is divided into different sections, like hours, days, weeks, and so on and so forth. So the bigger span of time is divided into four yugas, like Satya Yuga, Treta Yuga, Dwapar Yuga, and Kali Yuga. And the duration of those different yugas are like, we are in Kali Yuga. And the duration of Kali Yuga is 432,000 years. The duration of Dwapar Yuga is 864,000 years. The duration of Treta Yuga is 1,296,000 years, and the duration of Satya Yuga is 1,728,000 years. And so now we are in Kali Yuga, and in Kali Yuga actually the degradation begins, and due to the degradation people lose their memory. Like prior to Kali Yuga, people could remember everything just by hearing once they could remember. But now, you see, people are going to lose their memory. So when the memory became weaker, then there appeared the need to write, because people could not just retain everything in their heads. And that was the time Vasudev, he decided to write down the Vedas, and he did that. He divided the Vedas into four, he wrote them down. Then after dividing the Vedas, Riksham, Jaju and Atharva, he wrote the Upanishads and Puranas. And then he gave the Vedanta Sutra, and then he wrote the history in the form of Mahabharata. And but still he was feeling quite despondent. He was not fully satisfied in heart. So then, in his despondency, when he was lamenting that his work hasn't been fully perfected or has been fully accomplished, then his spiritual master, Narad Muni, came. And Narada instructed him, told him that, Vyas, you have wrote everything in details, but you have not fully glorified the Lord. And that's why your heart is still afflicted and you're feeling that your work hasn't been fully completed. And Narad Muni gave him four shlokas as the essence of the Bhagavatam. And that's called Chatushloki Bhagavata. Chatu means four and shloki means verses. In four verse forms, he gave the essence of the Bhagavatam. And then Vyasdev, he elaborated that and purely glorified the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That is the beginning of Bhagavatam. And actually Bhagavatam is the essence of the Vedas. Philosophically also, it has been pointed out that the Vedas have been divided into three sections. The Karmakanda, Jnanakanda and Upasanakanda. And there is further division that these three divisions have been further modified by six branches of philosophers known as Karma Mimamsa, Naya, Vaisheshika, Sankha, Yoga and Vedanta Sutra. So these are actually the gradual elevations, and ultimately it comes to Vedanta Sutra, which is giving the Vedic philosophy in nutshell, in gist, the gist of the Vedic philosophy, or the absolute synthesis of the Vedic conclusions. And Bhagavatam is actually the explanation of that Vedanta Sutra. The purport of Vedanta Sutra is actually Srimad Bhagavatam. Now, the first person who actually to write this Vedanta Sutra was actually Srimad Bhagavatam, to elaborate Vedanta Sutra was Vyasadeva. But Vyas did not write it in the beginning. He composed it, he compiled it, and he kept it in his memory. And then he gave it to his son, Sukadeva Goswami. And Sukadeva Goswami, he was a renunciate practically from his birth. He didn't want to get entangled in the materialistic affairs. So he left home and went to the forest. And then Vyasadeva brought him back and gave him the Bhagavatam, taught him Srimad Bhagavatam. And then Sukadeva Goswami left home, went away. He kept on traveling without any attachment to anything. At that time, King of India was Parikshit, King Parikshit. He was the grandson of Arjun. The Battle of Kurukshetra was over. The Pandavas, after that, Pandavas left their kingdom. And the successor to the throne was Arjun's only surviving person, actually, after the Battle of Kurukshetra in the family, in the Pandava line, was Parikshit, the son of Abhimanyu. I'm sure you all know about that. So Parikshit, they instated Parikshit in the kingdom, in the throne, and then they left for Mahaprasthan to give up their body. So Parikshit became the king, and Parikshit, in his mature age, was cursed by a Brahmin that he would die within 7 days by being bitten by a serpent called Takshak. And when Parikshit heard that he has only 7 days left, then he went to the bank of the Ganges and he sat down to prepare himself to leave his body. And at that time he was inquiring, what should he do now that he has only 7 days left? What should he do now? And at that time all the sages and the philosophers assembled there. They got the news that the king is going to give up his body in 7 days' time. So all the sages of India assembled around the king, and different sages started giving different suggestions. But Parikshit was not contented. He was, some were talking about Karma Kanda, some was talking about Gyana Kanda. But Parikshit was not fully contented with those instructions. But at that time, a 16-year-old boy walked in. And just by his appearance, the assembled sages could understand that he is a very, very elevated person. He was a very elevated person. Because by the marks of, or the shape, or the marks of the body, different parts of the body, they could figure out. By his appearance, they could figure out. They didn't know who he was, and they wondered, is this that Sukadev Goswami, who we heard of but never seen before? And Vasudev was present there in the assembly, and Vasudev confirmed that yes, that is Sukadev, his son. And then Parikshit Maharaj asked Sukadev Goswami about the goal of his life, what he should do now. And Sukadev Goswami recited this Srimad Bhagavatam to him as the ultimate objective of life, or describing the ultimate objective of life. Even then, it was not written. Then, in that assembly, then Parikshit Maharaj died, Kali set in. At that time, realizing the appearance of the age of Kali, and realizing the degraded condition of this age, the sages got together and they were performing a 1,000-year-long sacrifice to purify the atmosphere in the age of Kali. And in that assembly, one day they all approached Suta Goswami. And Suta Goswami was asked to describe what is the ultimate goal of life and what brings the ultimate benefit to life. So then Suta Goswami, who was also present in that assembly when Parikshit Maharaj was to die, and he heard from Sukadev Goswami. When Sukadev Goswami was reciting, Suta Goswami heard Srimad Bhagavatam from him. And he repeated Srimad Bhagavatam to the sages in the Naimisharanya forest. And then, so this is actually the Bhagavad that we get, that is the narration of Suta Goswami in the assembly of the sages. And they actually gave the qualification, all the representing all the sages. Shaunaka Rishi, he was asking Suta Goswami the question. And he, one of the points he made there was, Taya kholu puranani, sheti hashani chanagha, dharma shastrana padhitani, dharma shastrani jannuta, akhatana padhitani, dharma shastrani jannuta. The Taya kholu puranani, you have mastered all the puranas. And sheti hashani chanagha, and also you have mastered the subjects like history and all the other Vedic branches. So you know the essence of the scriptures. So you please give us that wisdom. And that's why Suta Goswami gave them, started reciting Srimad Bhagavatam. So this is how Bhagavatam came to be. And, or I can say, this is the history of Bhagavatam. And This Bhagavatam actually describes the unalloyed glories of the Lord. Like unalloyed or uncontaminated, because usually people glorify the Lord with their personal motivation. God give me this, God give me that, or God I worship you because I want liberation, or I want this and that. So there are various kinds of, you know, desires blended with the worship of the Lord. But in Bhagavatam, there is no such desire. It was a complete complete and perfect glorification of the Lord without any motivation, without any material motivation. Let us say that. And so that's why Bhagavatam has been considered to be the Amal Puran, or the Puran that doesn't have any contamination. There are 18 Purans. Out of the 18 Purans, 6 are in the mode of ignorance, or and 6 are in the mode of passion, and remaining 6 are in the mode of goodness. Now, the 6 in the mode of goodness, out of them, 5 are actually in the mode of goodness, and the 6th one, that is Srimad Bhagavatam, is in the mode of pure goodness, or transcendental mode. It is transcendental to the material nature, and that has very clearly been explained in the very beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam. The first sloka of Srimad Bhagavatam is the invocation, but the second sloka, which is the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, is describing that when one gives up all material desires, when heart becomes completely purified, then one becomes a saint, or a saint, or a saintly person. That dharma prajjhita koitabo atro paramo nirmat sharanam satam. Dharma means religion, and koitabo means cheating. Now, there are religions that are that has been considered to be cheating religion or mixed religion, that has some material desires blended with it. Now, in the Vedas, the other branches of dharmas or practices has been considered to be not pure religion, but cheating religion. They are actually pretending to be, you know, glorifying the Lord, but actually the motivation is something else. I worship the Lord to get a lot of money, or worship the Lord to get a beautiful woman, worship the Lord to become very famous, or so and so forth. Now, that has been considered in the Vedas as the noimittic dharma. Now, dharma, actually one word leads to another. So, dharma literally means the inherent qualities of a substance. Like fire is a substance, and the inherent qualities of fire are heat and light. Now, wherever there is fire, there is bound to be heat and light. You can't separate heat and light from fire. So, heat and light is actually the dharma of fire. Liquidity is the dharma of water. So, this way, the inherent qualities of a substance is called dharma in Sanskrit. Now, a living entity is a substance. Spirit soul is a substance. And the inherent quality of the spirit soul is to love God. So, that is the dharma of the spirit soul. So, that is how the real dharma has been described as the pure, loving propensity of a living entity to love the Lord. And the living entity's pure desire to love God is the dharma. But all the other activities that goes on in the name of dharma is not really dharma as such. So it is said that when one gives up all these cheating propensities that goes on in the name of religion and becomes fully purified from all kinds of material contaminations and material desires, then his heart becomes completely purified. And at that stage, Veddo Vastava Matra Vastu, at that stage only he can understand God, the absolute reality. And understanding that absolute reality, understanding God, one becomes free from the miseries of material existence. Tapotraya nunmulanam. And Srimad Bhagavate Mahamunikrite King Ba Parivishara. The Srimad Bhagavatam that has been composed or compiled by Vasudev, that describes that understanding of the Lord and how to develop that loving relationship to the Lord in a most pure way. And the third shloka of Bhagavatam has further described that it says, Nigamo kalpotarur golitam phalam. Nigamo means the Vedas. Nigamo kalpotarur. And the Vedas have been compared to a desire tree. A desire tree is a tree that can fulfill all desires. Like regular tree gives just fruits and flowers. But a desire tree can give whatever we actually desire. And it is said that in the spiritual sky, there are desire trees that fulfill all desires. And Vedas have been compared to a desire tree. Because by approaching the Vedas, we can fulfill all our desires. Whatever we want, we can fulfill that desire just by approaching the Vedas. And Nigama Kalpatarur Golitam Phalam Shuka Mukhad Omrita Drava Sangyutam. And that Vedas, Vedic knowledge, is the ripened fruit of the desire tree. And that has been blended with the nectar from the mouth of Sukadeva Goswami. Because he repeated it. And Shuka Mukhad Omrita Drava Sangyutam. And Pivata Bhagavata Rasam Alayam. Muhuraho Roshika Bhubi Bhavuka. Those who are expert in relishing the mellows, they can appreciate and then drink this Bhagavatam all the time. So this is just to talk about the history and the essence of the Bhagavatam teachings. Well, I think now we can, yeah.
Yes, we give an opportunity for questions. If anybody wants to ask a question about lecture so far.
I just ask a question. Do you belong to the Tengarai?
Do I belong to?
The Tengarai region among the Vaishnavas. The south?
Oh, no. We belong to the Madhva Gauriya Vaishnava.
So, the Vaishnava lives in the south. Tengarai and
Naragarai,
two different way of
reaching. Oh, I see. No, I'm not familiar with that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's alright. Do you know who, from which branch? Actually, there are four branches of Vaishnav. Four Vaishnav branches, you can say. The Madhva, Sri, Ramanuja, yeah. Sri, that's Sri Sampradaya.
The eighth way and the cat way.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's the logic. Yeah, right. That is Marjar Nai and Markat Nai.
Right.
Right. Yeah. The Marjar means the cat.
Yeah.
The cat, the mother cat, right, takes the baby cat in the mouth. But this mouth, that the jaw of the cat or the teeth of the cat is very sharp. And to a mouse, it means death, right? But the baby cat is very relaxed in the mouth of the mother, and mother is taking the baby cat, and he knows that wherever my mother takes me, it's all going to be all beneficial for me. That's called the Marjar Nai. And then the other is called Morkat Nai, the monkey mother, yeah, jumps from tree to tree, and the baby monkey just clings onto the mother's lap. And if he lets go the grip, then he will fall from the height and probably he'll die. But he never lets it go. So that is, these two nayas have been also adopted, or a simile has been given according to the Vaishnava approach. Vaishnava approach is that Vaishnava, like a monkey, baby monkey, holds on to the mother, the same way he holds on to the lotus feet of the Lord with all his might, with all his dedication.
In the south. Right.
Well, actually, we make a combination. I mean, we say we have to hold on to the lotus feet of the Lord, and at the same time, whatever the Lord does for us is for our benefit. Like a cat, baby cat does not care where his mother is going to take, whether it's going to be good for him or not. He knows wherever his mother takes him is going to be good for him. So same way, we believe whatever the Lord does for us is going to be all for our benefit. So we depend on him, and at the same time we hold on to his lotus feet.
And this is at the same time the question which comes through quite a lot of Western theology. And whether you can do something for your salvation or you should rely completely on the mercy of God. This is a general problem also in Western theology.
Well, I mean, if I may give our ideas towards that. The thing is that a living entity has been endowed with his will and with his faculty to act. Now, he has to use his will and the faculty to act to approach the Lord. With all his ability, he must try. But then ultimately, he cannot really, just by dint of his own endeavor, he cannot really reach the spiritual realm. Just his endeavor is not enough. The main criterion for his going back to the spiritual sky depends on the mercy of the Lord. So on our part, we must endeavor. But ultimately, it is the mercy of the Lord that will take us there. So we have to endeavor at the same time, depend on his mercy. Now, if somebody doesn't make any endeavor but just depend on his mercy, he's lazy. Right? So that wouldn't work. And if somebody just tries with his endeavor but does not depend on the Lord's mercy, that also will not work. So there has to be a proper adjustment and combination.
Isn't the question to be strange, because if one discusses whether one can do something for liberation or not, one has to define who, when one says one has to do something, who is one? If one is God, then the sense would be very strange. If God will do something for his own salvation. If I could do something or not for my salvation, because but if I am God within, within Christianity or Hinduism, that would be
that's a good, very good question. Yeah, but the main point is that living entity is not God. God is eternally God, and living entities are eternally subordinate to God. Right?
But that the human being is the inner nature of a human being must be the same as the inner.
Yeah, both are spiritual. Both are spiritual. God is the supreme spirit, and living entities are minute spirits, right? Like a big fire and a spark. Qualitatively, a spark also is fire. But when the spark falls in the heap of ash, then the spark is extinguished. It loses the quality of fire. So same way, the jiva or living entity, qualitatively it is spiritual, as long as it remains in the spiritual nature, in contact with the Lord. But the moment it leaves the spiritual nature and comes in contact with the material nature, it loses the spiritual qualities and becomes material. Right? Like a spark becoming ash.
But isn't that more on the level of experience? Because I cannot see how, if there are a supreme reality, that must be the same, whether you call it God or whether it's located to a person. If one talks that something has an intrinsic nature, then it cannot be different, because then break the whole definition of what one means with that something has an essence. It's one thing that one can experience, whether
one person can experience what another person cannot experience what maybe.
Actually, everybody can experience God,
yeah,
provided he is approaching in the right direction. Right? If somebody doesn't take the right direction, then he can't experience God. For instance, say, if you want to go to Stockholm, there is a road to Stockholm. Anyone who takes that road will go to Stockholm. But if somebody wants to go to Stockholm, but instead of going north, goes to south, he'll not end up in Stockholm. Right? So the process is very important. We have to follow the right process. And as far as your experience is concerned, like, experience may differ. Right? But reality does not depend on experience. Right? Reality is truth. And whoever experiences the reality will end up with the same conclusion. Right? But if somebody does not approach the reality, then his experience will differ with the ones those who have.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of concerning this question, whether we can do something or not. That question can only be put in the context of a human person experience. You're talking about knowledge, something, if we don't consider whether we can experience it or not, then that question cannot be stated. But it's irrelevant from on the logical perspective or something. It's just, if we discuss different persons' personal experiences, then maybe we can talk about whether I can do something or not.
Yeah, to clarify my example, I'll give another example. You see, somebody breaks the law of the state and he's put into prison. Now, if he wants to come out of the prison, why he's put into the prison? Because his consciousness is perverted. Right? He's not actually, his consciousness is not fit to be in the free world. So that's why, to rectify his consciousness, he's put into the prison. Now, if he wants to come out of the prison, then he'll have to rectify his consciousness. He has to give up his prisoner or criminal mentality. Right? And to give up the criminal mentality depends upon him. His endeavor. He's endeavoring to give up his criminal mentality. But then, his release from the prison actually depends on the sanction of the king or the state. When the state authority says that, well, now release him. Now, you see, the ultimate sanction comes from the Lord. But we individually have to try to give up our perverted mentality. So that's why, you see, like, endeavor and mercy, both are to be considered. Or both need to be applied.
I was just thinking very simply, because if God is everywhere, or if this reality is everywhere, then it's just a matter to realize it. And how we then define whether we realize that or that comes to us, it's just a matter of...
That's why, first of all...
I mean, we have to open up for that. We have simply thought from making it...
That's why, first of all, we have to understand that what is the meaning of God if God is everywhere? Right? Or who is God? Like, if you say God is everywhere and everything is God, right? Then you naturally conclude that this table is God. Right? But one of the definitions of God is omnipotent. Then you apply that quality of God to the table. Does it apply? Is the table omnipotent? No. Is the table omniscient? No. So that's why first we have to understand what is God. And when it is said that God is all-pervading, what it actually means.
I would say that the table is omnipotent. Because in its essence, of course, one talks about, if one says that the supreme reality is all-pervading, one means that the very essence of that table is...
That may be your concept, but that's not the reality. Like, say, the God created the entire universe. Let's take that point. Did the table create the entire universe? Leave aside the entire universe. Can this table create another table? It cannot. It cannot even produce one more cell outside of its own existence. So, you see, our concept may be one. Our concept is one thing, but reality may be totally different from that. But if we become tuned up to reality, then we become conscious of the reality. The understanding that Lord is all-pervading, it is because the Lord's energy, this material creation, is actually the manifestation of the Lord's energy. And the way the energetic is present in His energy, in that sense, the Lord is present everywhere. To give another, you know, analogy, like, in a way, you can say, the King of Sweden is present everywhere in Sweden. Right? Because it's His kingdom. So His rule, His domain spreads all over kingdom. In His energy, He spreads everywhere, spreads Himself everywhere. But personally, He may not be present everywhere. So that's why it is important to understand the Lord as the spiritual, supreme spirit. But this material nature is His energy or manifestation of His energy. Yes.
Now, what are the limits of the divine presence?
Divine?
Of the divine presence. You said that the divinity was not inherent in the table, for example. Can you more exactly describe the limits of the divine presence?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it in you and in me, maybe, but is it in my cat at home?
Yes.
So
yes.
Or
yeah.
Flowers.
Yeah, then we have to go back into the concept of creation. The understanding of creation is, you see, the Vedic philosophy basically deals with three aspects. The Lord, Ishvara, Jiva, the living entities, and Prakriti, the nature. Now, Prakriti is inert or inactive. Prakriti cannot function on its own, right? So, when the Lord's energy, the Jivas, are projected into the nature, or they are projected into the material nature, then the inert Prakriti or inert nature becomes manifest, becomes active. Like, for instance, you see, the Jivas are the spirit souls, the living entities. We all are actually Jivas, right? But when we came into the material nature, due to our coming, due to our presence here, the nature became agitated or active, right? So the everything in the material nature is actually the manifestation of the living entity's presence here, right? So for instance, to make an approach in that direction, I can say that this nature is manifest as long as I am here, right? When I am dead, this nature is not manifest to me, right? Same way, this nature is manifest to you because you are here, right? When you won't be here, it won't be manifest to you, right? So now, if all of us, all the living entities are withdrawn from the material nature, will there be any material nature or not? If there is no one to witness the material nature, right? Then there won't be any, the manifested, this nature will not be experienced by anyone or registered by anyone. So this nature actually depends on our existence here. That has been very nicely described in Bhagavad Gita by Krishna. He's describing the material nature. He says that Bhumi Rapo Anolo Bayu Khang Mano Buddhi Devacha Ahankaro Ityang Me Bhinna Prakriti Rashtadha. This separated energy of mind, this material nature, Krishna is saying that this separated energy of mind, this material nature, is composed of 8 elements. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, and mind, intelligence, and false ego. With these 8 elements, this is manifest. But aporeyam itastannam prakritim vidhi me param. But this nature, this material nature, is my separated energy. Beyond this separated energy, there is my inferior. Beyond this inferior separated energy, there is my superior internal energy. And the living entities are coming from that internal energy and they are sustaining this material nature. This material nature is sustained by the living entities, the spirit souls. Right? For example, this material nature is actually objective in nature. But object cannot manifest, object cannot exist without the subject. Right? It can.
But it cannot be experienced.
Well, yes, agreed. That's true.
It can. The table is still here when I left the room, for example.
Yes. But if there is no one to register the table, does it exist?
Yes, I think so. It does. It exists, but it is experienced by another.
Because that's, you see, the object is always dependent to subject. Without the subject, object cannot exist. Relative to the
scan.
I mean, no. If you take it conceptually, hypothetically, we can say that the table will exist. Now, to whom it will exist? To whose consciousness it will exist?
No.
Like, for instance, if there is no one to say there, if there is a flower in the middle of North Pole, where there is no one to see it. Does the flower exist or not?
It exists. I mean, it exists, and it is not experienced. But the concept of that flower doesn't exist either. The object of the flower does exist.
I see. Anyway, I take it, but I don't want to get into another tangent of discussion because.
But the distinction is absolutely
important. The thing is, like if the person, everything exists in relation to something. Because this is a relative nature, right? If somebody did not experience something, then it does not exist. If something does not exist to anyone, it is non-existent. And another thing is that this material nature is actually a projection of a living entity's mind. It is a projection of our mind. Like for instance, if there is no water, in a lake, will there be any reflection of the tree in the lake? The hole may be there, but if there is no water, will there be any reflection of the tree in the water, in the lake? It won't, because there is no water to reflect it. So the same way, our experiences are registered in the mind, and if there is no mind to register it, then obviously it does not exist.
But your analogy is false, because you should make an analogy between the tree and, for example, the table, and the mind and the water. You make the analogy false because you change these things.
No, I was just...
Even if there's no water, the tree still exists, I would say.
No, I was not saying that. A tree exists, but if there's no water, will the reflection exist?
No, the reflection wouldn't exist. But what corresponds to the reflection in the water corresponds to the mind.
Water is the mind, and this material nature is a reflection of the reality. So if there is no mind, where is the question of reflection?
No, it's not reflected anywhere, but it exists nonetheless. The tree still exists.
I do not deny that. I'm not talking about the tree, I'm talking about the reflection.
But we were starting with a discussion on the existence of the flower in the desert. I say the flower still exists, even if there's nobody who can see it.
Anyway, we can keep on arguing on that point, but it don't take us anywhere, right?
I think we can have something from Buddhist logic, because they have discussed this much. They would say that the blue and the experience of blue is the same. So we never have a pure experience of an object. In the experience there is inherent interpretation. They would also say that sound is just a sound when we hear it. Before we hear it, there is no sound. Because they would say everything is dependently originated. So a table is just a table when we see it. And in the perception of the table, that is an interpretation. So we don't know what the table as a thing in itself. We don't know. And the I and the object, and then visual consciousness arises, or the ear and some phonemes or something, and then sound arises. So in that way, one can actually say, it's according to a Buddhist philosophy, one would say that the table is just a table when we experience it. Before that, that's right, because everything is dependent or originated. The object cannot exist in itself as a separate from it. It's just an object when one experiences it. Otherwise, it's just infinite.
But the sound doesn't correspond to the. Of course, the sound. A sound can only be there as so. How we normally define a sound. So a sound can only, in its proper sense, be there when some human being or an animal. Is present. But the sound in this sense doesn't correspond to the table itself. But the sound corresponds to somebody's impression of the table, not the table itself.
Well, no, you say that, when I experience the table, it's a visual consciousness. My eye sees an object and then visual consciousness arises. Or my ear hears something, phonemes or something, and then when I hear this, I call that sound. The sound depends on the ear and that something out there, and then we call it sound.
Yes.
Like that, see, the same. That thing there, and my eye sees it, and then I get the experience of a table. But the table doesn't exist apart from that experience. Absolutely not. Because
why
I don't say that. Because when I see the table, there's no. It's not first that I see the table, then I interpret it as a table. So the table and the interpretation is the same. Before that, it's just dependent, the originator. So then they will just say that they could separate the table into small entities and they could infinitely regress. That is, it's absolutely empty, that table. It doesn't exist.
Do you seriously believe that when we have left the room here, that table disappears? That is actually what you are saying. Do you seriously believe that?
Actually, there is reason to believe. Yeah, if that it's not. I mean, we were saying that if somebody else comes into this room, then he will experience the table, right?
Yes.
But if there is no one existing, then will it exist or not? Because why I'm saying it is because there are in. According to the Vedic concept, there are three kinds of pralaya, means three kinds of annihilation. One annihilation is individual annihilation, and death is the individual annihilation. That's a partial annihilation. There is a temporary annihilation, that is, at certain point, the whole creation, the universe has got 14 planetary systems, and out of that, 10 lower planetary systems are annihilated. In the fire of pralaya, or fire of annihilation. So that is also a temporary annihilation. But there is another kind of annihilation, that is total annihilation, when the whole creation dissolves. And that annihilation takes place by withdrawing all the living entities from the material nature. The material natures are injected, the living entities are injected into the material nature, and the material nature becomes manifest. And when all the living entities are withdrawn from the material nature, then the material nature automatically dissolves. So that is the three concepts of annihilation. So to go back to that point, the material nature becomes manifest due to the living entity's appearance into the material nature. Right? You see, the living entities are spiritual beings. And they come from the spiritual nature. And they're projected into the material nature. And when they come into the material nature, then the material nature becomes manifest through them. Because it says, Jajidam dharjate jagat. The material nature is sustained by the living entity. Material nature cannot become active. Matter is inert, and matter cannot become active by itself. It needs a spiritual energy or spiritual presence to become manifest. Like my body is matter. But the body is living because my soul is in the body. Right? And when the soul leaves the body that has been living for so many years will drop dead and will become unconscious, will become inert. Right? So, the same way, that when all the souls are withdrawn from the material nature, then the material nature becomes inert. And through this living, and wherever there is a spirit soul, the Lord is present with the spirit soul as the super soul. To quote Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that Ishvara sarva bhutanam riddeshe arjuna tishtati. Now, Ishvara, the Lord, as Paramatma, super soul, is situated in everybody's heart. So that is how the Lord is present everywhere. Because He is there, He is even in every single molecule and atoms. But He is not active. Yes, He is. Every single atom. Right. Yes. But the Lord doesn't, in this material nature, the Lord doesn't become active. He is there. Like He is sitting in our hearts also. He is in your heart also. But in your heart, He is simply witnessing your actions and waiting when you are going to turn your face towards Him. Lord is sitting in our hearts, simply waiting when we are going to turn our face towards Him and try to establish a relationship with Him. Yes.
If you say so, then if we talk about subject and object, then every object is always present because it is present in towards the subject, that is the Lord, the God. He is always present everywhere, so it will always exist towards Him.
Yes.
Even if
as long as
here, we all live here, but He will still see the table, so the table exists.
Well, the Lord becomes present in the material nature along with the spirit, individual spirit soul. The soul and super soul. Lord is present with the super soul. Now, when all the souls are withdrawn from the nature, then the Lord also withdraws, because the super soul also goes back with the spirit soul.
Yes, that the table is a human convention. Therefore, it's not right to say that it can exist without the
Martin,
experience.
Can you get me some water, please?
If I want you to talk about the table, I would absolutely maintain that it's not existence if there is no observer. I mean, it's within the very concept of a table, it lies that it's you yourself who makes up the table. The table doesn't exist in ultimate reality.
That's an interesting direction that we can take. This material nature has been compared to a dream. This material reality has been compared to a dream. Now, when we dream in our sleep, then we actually see it in three dimensions. And to us, it's a reality. Right? But when you wake up, then the dream disappears. But as long as we are dreaming, it's real. It's three-dimensional. Right? Now, the difference between this material experiences, material reality and our dream is that this dream is an individual reality. Whereas this material nature is a collective dream. Individual dream is experienced individually. Like when you dream, I may be present in the same room, but I will not experience what you are dreaming. And what is actually a dream?
I don't know.
Yeah. Now, dream is the projection of your experiences. Like the experiences that you have, that is projected in your mind. When, the other senses of the body is inactive. Right? So that projection becomes three-dimensional in the mind. Right? Now, the difference between dream world and this world is, the dream is an individual perception, whereas this is a collective perception. Like, whoever is present in this room at this point of time will see this table. Right? But also, we'll depend it from our different perspective. Like, you will see the table from your angle of vision, I'll see it from my perspective, you're seeing it from your perspective. So different individuals will experience it from his own individual perspective. But actually it is an universal conception. But this nature is actually a reflection of the spiritual reality. Yeah.
This is French philosopher some time ago, and his theme was reality doesn't exist except in the language. How would you look at that?
The question is, what language? Like, if he's French and if I don't know French, it obviously doesn't relate to me.
There was a gentleman who said, God, I think it is extremely odd that this very tree will continue to be when there is no one about in the court. Reply, dear sir, your astonishment is odd. I am always about in the court. That's why the tree will continue to be, since observed by your faithful God.
Yeah, good. That's a very good point. Very good point. But here's one little difference, that God is present eternally in the spiritual nature, and that's why the spiritual nature is eternal. Everything in the spiritual nature is eternal, unperishable, because everything is being observed by God and everything is existing with God. But this nature, this material nature, is a separate arrangement for the living entities, those who have rejected God. So that's why material nature is not eternal, or we can say temporary. It has a beginning and it has an end. But the spiritual nature is eternally existing. Yes.
I would like to go back to the allegory about the butterfly, especially since we have two Chinese scholars here.
Mm-hmm.
There is a famous Chinese philosopher, which I'm sure you know of, whose name is Zhuang Zhou. And in his second chapter, which is called Qi Wu Lun, on making things equal, he has a dream. His name is Zhuang Zhou, but he calls himself Zhou. He was once dreaming that he was a butterfly, and he was very happy being a butterfly fluttering around in the field with all the flowers. Suddenly he woke up and realized he was not a butterfly. But now the philosopher sat down and was thinking, am I a butterfly who is dreaming I'm Zhuang Zhou, or am I Zhuang Zhou who dreamt I was a butterfly? Certainly there is a difference between the butterfly and Zhuang Zhou. But where do we draw the limit?
Yeah. So my answer to that will be, the unreal is always unreal, from whichever perspective you look at it. Na shato vidyato bhavo, na bhavo vidyate shato. That is temporary or unreal is always unreal, but that is real is always real and ever existing.
But how can we be sure that we are not actually dreaming, that we are sitting here?
Wake up from your sleep. Then you don't dream anymore. Actually, this is actually an existence, you know. We are asleep actually. We are in ignorance of the reality. We are asleep, and in a sleep, the way you have different dreams, in ignorance, we are also having different experiences, different dreams. Sometimes we are butterflies, sometimes we are grasshoppers, sometimes we are cats and dogs, and sometimes we are human beings. So different experiences we are going through. But when you wake up from that sleep, when you come out of the ignorance, then there is no more dream or no more unreal experiences. And that's why the Vedic, first instruction of the Vedas is Tamosho Ma Jyotirgamayo. From the region of ignorance, you enter into the region of light.
And how do we pass this limit from ignorance into reality?
Yeah. You see, the absolute reality is God. Mm. And when you become related to God, then we also become situated in reality. And when we separate ourselves from God, then we can enter into the region of ignorance or unreality. And now, see, in this nature, we are forgetful of God. We have forgotten God, and that's why we are actually going through all kinds of unreal experiences. But when we re-establish our relationship with the Lord, then we become situated in reality.
How can this relationship be established? Is it enough for us to think about God, or we turn towards Him, or is it necessary that He also turns towards
us? Right, yeah. Right.
Or
that's
both
why,
of them?
Right. That's why the religion is there. Religion means re-linking. To re-establish our lost relationship with the Lord. Right? And the process has been given by the Lord Himself, or is given by His bona fide representatives. They come and they give us the process. Dharmam tu shakshat bhagavat pranitam. Religion is the laws given by the Lord. And that those laws are established by the Lord Himself. And sometimes He sends His Son, or His Son sends His representatives to establish that law. But the law remains the same. If the Father says the law or the Son says the law remains the same. And whoever follows, and the process that is given, that is religion. And that is the way to be related or to religioned to the Lord. Yes.
What are your criteria for waking up?
Criteria for waking up?
How do you know that you have woke up?
Yeah. Then you become situated in knowledge, and you can see the others, those who are around you, they are also awake, and they are also relating to that absolute truth. And the process actually begins by somebody who is awake. He comes and shakes you up and tells, wake up, wake up. Why are you dreaming unnecessarily? So it needs another person who is awake. And that is the spiritual master or spiritual preceptor who comes and shows us. Like naturally, generally people don't think that they're asleep. Right? They think that they're fine. Everything is all right. Huh? Although he's suffering, he thinks I'm all right. But then somebody comes and tells him that, look, nothing is all right with you. You are actually miserable. You are going through all kinds of traumatic experiences and you are not feeling all right. So you wake up and you will find whatever you are looking for. And then we wake up and we see, yes, that's true. It is there. Whatever you are looking for. And what do we actually look for? We are looking for joy. Everyone is looking for joy or bliss. It's not, I won't say happiness. Happiness has been defined as the cessation of pain. We are in a painful state, and when the pain is reduced to some extent, then we think that we are happy. Right? But joy and happiness are not quite the same thing. Joy is the thing that is everlasting, that's eternal, and that brings full satisfaction to the heart, to our existence. And when we wake up in that reality, then we automatically become joyful. And other criterions also are that two other inherent desires that we have are that we do not want to die and we want to know everything. Now, when we wake up in that reality, then we see that we are immortal. We do not die. It is the body that dies. Death is actually my leaving this body. When I leave this body, then the body becomes dead. But I never die. Spirit never dies. Spirit is eternal. And the spirit is all situated in eternal knowledge as well. So when you become situated in our spiritual identity, then ignorance is automatically removed and we become situated in knowledge. We become situated in immortality and we experience constant joy or eternal bliss.
But you can be asleep and dream that someone comes to wake you up.
Yes. Well, that's a dream again. Because my point is...
I don't know whether you are asleep or not.
Right. The point is, you see, like when you are dreaming, you may see all kinds of incoherent things. You may even see that somebody is coming and waking you up, and so and so forth. But when you wake up, then you are situated in knowledge, or your wakeful state dispels or removes all the dreams, right? Then you are situated in reality. So to be awake literally means to be situated in reality, and to be asleep means to be situated in unreality and think that that is reality.
And it is a big problem to be a daydreamer.
Yes. That's a good question. As you just said, who knows? Actually, we have to find a person who knows, right? That's why it is important that when one takes to spiritual life, one has to have a spiritual master. Like, if I want to study physics, then I have to go to somebody who knows physics. I can't just buy a few books from the market and start reading them and become a physicist. I have to study under somebody. So the spiritual subject, spiritual reality also has to be studied under a qualified teacher. And that teacher is the spiritual master or guru. And every religion actually propounds that, because the spiritual nature is beyond our sense perception. We cannot perceive the spiritual nature with our material senses. Our material senses registers only the material object. So that's why spiritual nature is called adhokshaja or achinto. It's beyond even our mental perception. Chinta means thought, and it is beyond our mental perception. And achinto kholu je bhava na tang starke na jojayet. That reality that is beyond our sense perception can never be understood by argument or intellectual speculation. It has to be received from somebody who has the knowledge. Bhagavad Gita also Krishna says, tad vidhi pranipatena pariprasnena sevaya upadekshanti te jnanam jnaninas tattva darshina. The process of understanding this spiritual reality is that we have to approach a qualified teacher in a humble state of mind, and we have to inquire from him sincerely. Then he will impart the knowledge unto us, because he has the knowledge. He has seen the truth. Otherwise, you know, one blind man will lead other blind man to a ditch. Right?
Doesn't matter. Since you are anyway eternal, why is it so necessary that you understand? Is that understanding the absolute one can be liberated?
Yeah, it is necessary. Yeah.
But I am anyway eternal. In the heart of my existence, I am eternal anyway. So why is it so important that I understand?
Yeah, it is important because otherwise we do not get what we are craving for.
I can understand that it is important for this life.
Yeah.
That I am suffering because I don't understand the rest of the days I have here. But in the perspective of the eternal kalpas,
yeah,
it is
insignificant.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that the understanding in this context means, I don't know if I should.
No, go ahead.
You have that, as I understand it here, that means both, not only an intellectual understanding, but primarily an experience. It's like, I know I'm a millionaire, but as long as I haven't connected my bank book to my bank account, I will not have I cannot benefit from that. Having the intellectual understanding that I have unbounded power within is going to increase my suffering, actually. Because if I don't use, I know I have it, but I don't use it, it's really...
Yeah, that's a very good point, yeah. Yeah.
I have another question here. Are there many awakened? Do you think there are some awakened people in the world?
At least I know one thing. that my spiritual master, Prabhupada, was a self-realized soul. He was awake. And he showed us the process, how to wake up. And at least we try to, if we try to, as long as we are trying to, you know, follow the process to wake up, someday, sometime we are going to wake up, as long, you know, and the, now the main, most important thing is that we follow the process that he has given. Yes.
I would like to ask a question on morality.
Sure.
Which are the differences between ISKCON and ordinary Hinduism?
You see, what is going on in the name of Hinduism today is just some following of some rituals, right? Like quote Will Durant, I'm sure you are familiar with him. He is saying that a religion remains religion for first few years. Then it becomes a philosophy. Then it becomes a political convenience. And then it becomes a mere ritual. So what is going on in the name of Hinduism is just some, you know, following some rituals of the Vedas without any understanding or conviction, right? Whereas ISKCON is trying to follow the essential teachings of the Vedas. They're trying to practice the essential teachings of the Vedas. And they're doing it with full awareness and complete understanding. And that's why you will see that people from all different parts of the world, from different religious, social background, are practicing this process in the ISKCON movement. So they are not actually following Hinduism. Although I myself was born as a Hindu, but I do not see that I am a Hindu myself now. Because I'm not, you know, sort of, I don't want to identify myself into a narrow limit of some following some rituals. Whereas real religion is universal. We, following rituals, when the rituals are practiced with knowledge, then it is not bad, it's positive. But if the rituals are followed without knowing, without having the proper understanding, then it is a waste of time. Yes, we have Sandha Aratik, we call it, the worshipping the Lord in the evening. Yes, we have. The thing is that the practice, when I said rituals, I actually meant, I guess Will Durant meant a negative side of the ritual, right? Like not practicing something without knowing the without knowing the meaning or the purpose behind it. Yes, we do. So that's not a ritual. I won't say this is a ritual. And that's a way of life. That's our way of life. That's a basic, very part of our life. And we know why you are doing that. We know why you why we are doing it. Because the basic understanding is that we want to develop our love for the Lord. Right? But a person who doesn't have any understanding of the Lord, who doesn't have any inclination to develop his loving relationship with the Lord, if he goes through some practices, then that is, you know, useless waste of time.
What I said just now, that is to say that each country is more practice in religion.
Yes. Right. And actually our spiritual master Srila Prabhupada didn't want to identify ourselves as Hindus as such. Because once some people approached him in America and asked him, why are you converting the Christian boys and girls into Hindus? Prabhupada's reply was that, no, I'm not converting the Christians into Hindus or Christians into Jews or Jews into Muslims. He said, I'm simply making better Christians out of the Christians, better Jews out of the Jews, better Muslims out of the Muslims, and better Hindus out of the Hindus.
Practicing the
real religion.
I would like to ask about the teachers. There is a lot of teachers, religious teachers around. How do you see that one is a good teacher and one from one who is not a good teacher?
Yeah, that's a nice question. You see, we have been endowed with a very beautiful faculty called intelligence. And that intelligence allows us to discriminate from right from wrong. And if we are open, right, then if we are open and if we see how the person acts and what he teaches, whether there is any link between his preaching and practice, whether he preaches what he practices what he preaches. By watching him, by seeing him, we can very easily understand who is the right one and who is the wrong one. I mean, for instance, I can say personally, like, I went back to India in search of a guru. And for 1.5 years, I was searching for a guru. When I went, I thought that as soon as I go to India, I'll find my guru and he'll show me the way. I thought it would be so easy to find a guru. But when I went there and started looking for one, it took me 1.5 years and I couldn't find a single one. Till I got a book of Srila Prabhupada. I didn't even see him. I got a book of Srila Prabhupada. And when I started reading, then I realized, yes, this is what I was looking for. And I have seen, like, as the time, in the beginning I thought that, well, let me try it out. If it's not all right, I'll leave. And my hair will grow in 2 months. So it's not a big risk. And I have been in the movement for the last 12 years. And I can tell you, my faith is becoming stronger and stronger with passing of every day. Prabhupada also used to say that you see a sadhu not with your eyes. You see a sadhu with your ears. With your ears. Hear what he speaks. Not see how he looks like. Right? From the looks he may be deceptive, but from his instructions, we'll be able to understand whether he is giving the right instruction. Yes. Yeah. It's quite a stimulating discussion. Thank you very much.
Once again, I have the impression that ISKCON is not only bhakti, but it's also very philosophical, very practical. So the impression is confirmed again, it's sort of integration of the different Jewish ways. So thanks for coming and taking your time.
It was my pleasure all throughout. I had your wonderful association, and now I had the association of so many nice, very thoughtful, intelligent people. We have some books. So we'd like to give you all some books. And please. Oh yeah, we have some sweets also. Let me give the sweets.